Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
Know the signs. Say something. Save lives. Melissa in the Morning presents Say Something Week. Now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
We are continuing the conversation this week. It is National Say Something Week, which is a campaign done across the country, and it's something very near and dear to the hearts of those who run the Sandy Hook Promise nonprofit, for example. Say something after you see something, and you could save lives, exactly what the slogan says. And yesterday we talked about middle and high school students having curriculum and clubs in place to help them to learn about See Something, Say Something. So today I thought, why don't we go to the next level? Let's go to the college level. And joining us is a very frequent guest on our show, Gary McNamara. He was the former chief of police in Fairfield, but is now the chief executive director of public safety and government affairs at Sacred Heart University. Welcome back to the show, Gary. Good morning.
Good morning and happy St. Patrick's Day.
Thank
Melissa.
You, friend. You too. Thank you. Appreciate you being here. It's a very important week, and I'm wondering from going from your post being the chief at a fire at the police department rather, and then going to a college campus. What did you bring, would you say, from your professional background in law enforcement to college students and the fact that See Something, Say Something is still very much, I would say, important at any college campus?
Yeah, it is. And I think the key is that we are always continuing to learn. So even though, my experience is in the police department and as a police officer and police chief, were important, and they still are. I always continue to learn as well. So what I bring is my experience as a police officer, and oftentimes people might not necessarily think that their own behavior, matters. So as a police officer, we know that we can't be on point and hypervigilant all the time. We would lose our mind. So we have to know different circumstances, different situations that are going to heighten our level of awareness, because we can't all operate in a level of awareness all the time. We have to kind of find times when we're comfortable and we lower that level of concern and hypervigilance. So I think I kind of bring that. And in the university level, it's proving itself to be valuable. I mean, all of our students coming here have basically grown up with the See Something, Say Something mantra. They've all kind of were born around that 2001 year. So they're all kind of have grown up in that. And as your guest spoke about yesterday, they are learning and they're trained in the school environment. So when they come to us, they've already kind of had that level of preparedness. We just want to tweak it a little bit to make sure that they understand it's a new environment.
Do you find, Gary, though, at a college level, it's a little trickier than when you have middle and high school students? And I say that because, not everyone is taking the same classes. Not everyone lives in the same dorm. Some live off campus. Some are of age to drink. Some are not. Some are into drugs. Some are not. Some are in relationships. Some are, There's so many more factors where I think it's a little trickier, I would say, at the college level to assure that, say, something is alive and well, if you know what I'm saying.
No, you're absolutely right. And that's why it's so important that we support the efforts at the middle school and at those lower grades. I mean, we don't want to certainly harm children and make them so afraid of things, but we have to support that. I was with the leadership in the Shelton School District 2 days ago discussing threat assessment and, crisis management. And, we have to support those efforts because when they, they're all growing up. So what we can do with lower grades and the lockdown drills and things that you can do in the lower grades, you really can't do that at a university level. So we have to get that base of an understanding of what it means to be safe. And then we have to introduce a new environment. So we're actually helping them grow in a variety of different ways. One of those ways from our perspective is safety and understanding that they're in a new environment. They grow very comfortable like we all do in our neighborhoods, in our schools. We become comfortable. We're used to it. We know how to be safe there for the most part. And now you're coming into a totally different environment. You're growing up. You're living on your own. You're able to go places without telling people about it. So we have to kind of allow them to embrace that new environment, but understand that there's new safety concerns that they have to be aware of.
And I think there are more liabilities as well. Gary McNamara is here, the Chief Executive Director of Public Safety at Sacred Heart University. And what I mean by that, Gary, is I was learning a few weeks ago, I had a guest on the show who was had a background in pharmaceuticals, and he had said, you know, most people don't know, but if you are, for example, engaging in drug activity and you're the one who provides the drug to a friend and they overdose, if you call 911, you are actually not going to get charged. Now, I believe, as long as they survive. But you basically, you walk away scot-free. And most people probably have no idea that that's the truth, and they will hide or say, let me figure this out. There's no way I'm getting cops involved in this one because I'm going to get in trouble. I provided the drugs. And when I heard that, I immediately connected it to something like a see something, say something. And I wonder if when you've got young adults who are in college and you're at a party, for example, where there's a lot of drinking going on, or you're tipsy yourself and you're worried about see something, say something. Like if you see a friend being taken advantage of, or you see someone who seems shady, you're in this very vulnerable place where you're like, right, but I'm guilty by association because I am here. So how do you bridge that? How do you overcome the fear of I'm also here, I'm seeing it, but I'm also engaging in the activities going on, but I'm going to do the right thing and report something. Does that make sense what I'm asking?
Yeah, it absolutely does. I mean, we've seen it across the country at college age level, even at high school level, where drinking parties happen and somebody drinks to the point of passing out and dies as a result of alcohol poisoning, and they never call because they're afraid. It's through conversations. It's through engagement. It's through ongoing discussion to make sure they recognize that, and providing resources. Like, we have an anonymous reporting system that can call and report anonymously. And it is anonymous. So there's no way we can find out, you know, who it is. And so they can report different things. We can respond to them. And it's really making them, or helping them, grow up. And that's really the point of it, is understanding, as we all function through our daily living, we always are aware of who we're associating with. Am I going to get in trouble for this if I'm with somebody? So we have to continue to have those conversations to make sure that they understand the liability if they do nothing. Because at the end of the day, you know, if people are drinking, we don't want them to drink, and we certainly don't want them to drink excessively. But if they do and someone's passed out, you can't let that go. You have to get them help to make sure that they're going to be okay. Otherwise, we've seen the tragedy that can happen.
Mm-hmm. We're chatting this morning with Gary McNamara. He's the Chief Executive Director of Public Safety and Government Affairs at Sacred Heart University. And during Say Something Week, it's a little more challenging for the college-level students to do see something, say something. Now, Gary had said earlier in this conversation, look, a lot of these kids grew up in an era where they, you know, they watch things like 9/11 happen. They've seen and they've heard about, unfortunately, school shootings, and they're very familiar with it. So it's been talked about at their schools. But Gary, interestingly enough, you had told me recently that you did a sit down at in Fairfield with a group of high school seniors, specifically females, on, you know, being safe. And one of the things that kind of stood out to you was the need for parents to also have this safe mindset for their students. Why do you say that?
You know, because it's a transition. And I think that the parents and the students all need to understand, when they go into that new environment, they need to understand it. They need to know the resources. They need to know how to communicate safely. These students who are graduating and going to a university are actually transitioning. You know, high school was a time when a lot of their safety was the responsibility of someone else, similar to everything you do when you get to college, you know, homework and assignments. You know, when you get to the university, a lot of the responsibilities, and one of them being more of a safety responsibility, falls on your shoulders. And the parents need to understand what the safe environment will look like. How do they communicate with their children and make sure that they understand that they're now venturing into a world where their safety now starts to fall a little bit more on their responsibility. And that's why those conversations are so important. You know, we take what they learn in high school with safety, and then we just add and tweak it and say, you're kind of moving into a different world now. Welcome. You're moving into a different world from being a little bit more of a spectator, and you can help now shape the safe environment on a college campus. And that's really important.
I see, because there's only so long as a parent that you can protect your kids before they have
That's
to
right.
start doing it themselves. I see what you're saying. That is a hard transition. That's it. You know, sometimes it's interesting because the kids are so ready for that transition. Some are nervous, you know, and worried about it. But would you say the parents have a harder time with that transition? Because even with like see something, say something, you know, you've got the parents who are very involved. Even when you watch these news stories of lockdowns and things like that, the parents are in complete, for good reason, are in complete meltdown mode, you know, and I think it's so real for them. And it's those moments of I have no control, even though your kids are at the high school or middle school level. But now you're talking about, in a lot of cases, they're states away, they're far away. It may have to take a plane or a car or whatever the case may be. But do you find that the parents struggle more with the concept of see something, say something at the college level?
I think they do. I think they do. And I think, you know, the way I look at it is, especially here at Sacred Heart University, I am developing a partnership with the parents and the students. And we all are here. Because like you said, there's some parents that we have who live in California. And they come here for orientation, and we do a big presentation on safety and what it looks like here. And then at the end of it, I say, look, you're 6, 8, 7, 8 hours away.
Right.
If
what
something
can you
happens,
do?
If you're a concern, if you're concerned about the health or something that your child calls up and says they don't feel well and you can't get hold of anybody else, call me or call us. At least you have a voice that can say, you know, hey, this is where we're at. We have to look at safety as a partnership. And above all else, we've got to look at some of the other issues. Uber, we saw those stories about the Uber issues. And maybe at some point we can talk a little bit more specifically on Uber apps and how you can protect yourself. We have to learn from other incidents. There's a lot of incidents around the country that have been averted that we don't hear a lot about. And we have to learn from that. That's what I discussed with Shelton leadership the other day. There are incidents that didn't happen because people saw something. And more importantly than see something, I want to add one thing to it. It's look for something. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be obsessive, but you want to look for something. Safety is proactive. It's not reactive. And you don't want to obsess with it, but you want to look for something. If you're going from your car to your dorm room, look for stuff. Don't say, yeah, I happen to see something. Looking for something, say I'm actively kind of looking for it and transition. So there's a lot of things that we discuss and we continue to discuss, but we all know that safety is an ever-changing discussion and an ongoing discussion that we always have to have. We have to weigh that against their mental health, their mental wellness, so we don't make them so afraid to do anything, but we have to weigh it against making sure that we all continue to keep safety at the forefront.
I mean, and it has to keep changing. When you look at the threats and how things have changed even in 20 years, Gary, you know, I was saying earlier in the show, when I entered high school, we barely had flip phones. Things are changing. I mean, social media wasn't a thing when I was in high school. It was barely a
That's
thing
right.
when I was in college. So,
That's
I mean,
right.
threats change, and the way that we're, you know, having to look for things is changing. It's changing.
Yeah, absolutely. And our discussions always have to change. And that's why I said at the beginning that I'm always learning, because we can say be aware of your surroundings. But what do you do when half of your senses are occupied by something that's not making you aware? You
right.
have ear pods in. You're looking at your phone. So you're not seeing anything because you're looking at your phone. You're not hearing anything because you have your ear pods in. So we're basically saying if you see something, say something. Well, you're not seeing anything but your phone. We have to kind of embrace those discussions and say at times you have to make sure you're always aware of it. Yeah, it always changes and we always have to adapt. But these conversations you're having all week and an ongoing basis you always have, that's why they're so important. Because we don't obsess with it, but we want to always keep it in the forefront. And again, it's relationships and partnerships that keep us all safe.
Amen to that. Gary McNamara, the Chief Executive Director of Public Safety and Government Affairs at Sacred Heart University, thank you so much for being part of this week's conversation of Say Something Week. We appreciate it.
You got it, Melissa. Be well.
All right, you too.
And now, a few minutes with U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal on WICC 600.
Senator Richard Blumenthal, welcome back. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me back.
Yes. Well, of course, you're always welcome back to the show, but I mean, welcome back to the United States. What a trip you went on this past weekend. Could you tell us about it?
Well, it was really a very moving, impactful visit for me, going to Poland and visiting the border, seeing the hundreds of refugees that morning coming across, almost all of them women and children, carrying most of what they had on their back, teddy bears, pets, leaving their homes, almost all of them women and children, because the men stayed behind to fight, and the terror and tragedy on their faces, tears and grief, but also tremendous courage and resilience. And these refugees were escaping, many of them, a bombing that had occurred just hours before, 12 miles away, just 12 miles away from the border, when the Russians sent missiles at a training center that killed 35 and injured 135 or more. And that was just 12 miles from where we were. The Polish authorities at the border said the ground shook and the tremors reached them. But what struck me was the human impact, and the fate of these refugees is truly a humanitarian crisis. But we also heard about the security situation, the need for more defense supplies and military arms, particularly missiles, to counter the Russians' reign of terror from the skies, which is just so terrible, killing people, innocent civilians, hitting hospitals and maternity wards, nurseries and residences. And people were describing what it was like to live there and the need for better defense against the Russian aircraft and missiles that are delivering those bombs. So it was very, it was really a very moving and important trip for me.
Had you ever seen, do you think, anything like that, Senator Blumenthal? Like, what would you compare everything you just described? What would you compare that to in your professional career, in your political career, seeing something like that?
I think it's hard to compare that sight, those sounds and faces, the conversations that we had with those refugees about their families still remaining, the loved ones that they feared might be lost. I don't know whether I can compare it to anything that has been in my experience before, but it was certainly something that's occurring every day at that border, the border crossing in Korchova, which is just 12 miles from that training center that was bombed. The closeness of the Russian bombing to Poland also struck me, because obviously Putin is extremely reckless as well as ruthless. He's bringing the bombing that close to Poland. Mm-hmm. One missile off course could have hit the 82nd Airborne, which was stationed and continues to be stationed on the Polish border there.
So from going there, Senator Blumenthal, what do you feel you accomplished?
Well, we brought back to our colleagues the issue in very real and human terms of those refugees. We also brought back the very important and compelling case for more aid to President Zelensky and the freedom fighters of Ukraine, because they can beat the Russians on the ground in a fair fight. They can push the Russians out of Ukraine. But those bombs and missiles that are driving those refugees from their homes are also raining down on the Ukrainian fighters, and they don't have a fair fight. Mm-hmm. If they had a fair fight, they can drive the Russians from their homeland. But the lesson that we brought back from the evidence we compiled, not only from what we saw and heard, but also from the intelligence briefings that we had from officials of the United States, from the military, the 82nd Airborne, from the others like Polish officials. We met with the defense minister, gave us a full picture of what is necessary, and clearly much more needs to be done for Ukraine to prevail in this struggle against Vladimir Putin's savage, insidious invasion.
When you say needs to be done, Senator Blumenthal, are you changing your tune on what President Zelensky is calling for, which is a no-fly zone?
The administration has ruled out a no-fly zone, but I think that there is a lot more that can be done, such
like
as more planes.
Mm-hmm.
such as more planes, more drones, more anti-aircraft batteries and missiles, more sophisticated anti-aerial equipment, such as they've been using increasingly. President Biden announced yesterday a major increase out of the $13.6 billion in the budget that we passed last week. You know, there is vastly increased aid in that budget. The drawdown yesterday of about $800 million will provide more grenade launchers, more drones, more Javelin and Stinger missiles, that kind of aid, but more of it, and more sophisticated drones and anti-aircraft equipment is what's needed to counter the Russians' air superiority that enables them to have this kind of pummeling, punishing effect on civilians, but also on the Ukrainian freedom fighters.
And my understanding, Senator Blumenthal, is that you also talked to high-ranking members of Poland. I have very dear friends who are from Poland who have now become Polish-Americans who have family there on the border. And they said that the situation of refugees coming in is so severe that schools have to shut down so that they can house people. They are overrun. I mean, the bordering countries taking in refugees while they are open arms and welcoming. What do you think about, you know, just from being at the border there and seeing what Poland is now up against, bringing in over a million, you know, I would think close to a million people at this point. What do you think about the support that they probably need?
By this point, it's probably more like 2 million or more, because 3 or more million have fled.
Have left.
To Poland and other countries, and it's imposing a tremendous burden on that country. We visited Warsaw, where 10% of the population now consists of those refugees.
Wow.
And it is imposing a tremendous burden on schools, hospitals, as well as homes. Mm-hmm. But here is something that's so impressive and uplifting. You know, Poles are welcoming them.
Yes.
They are opening their homes and their hearts. And the Poles themselves have been victims of invasions and persecution. And now they're opening their homes and arms to people who are victims of invasion and persecution. So there are a lot of bonds between the two peoples. There's a closeness. And it was very inspiring to see those refugees welcomed by the people of Poland.
Do you think, though, that it's putting countries like Poland at risk of being the next ones to be attacked because they're taking in so many Ukrainians?
Poland is a member of NATO. If Poland is attacked, the United States would be involved in direct confrontation with Russia. Ukraine is not a member of NATO, and therefore the president has said rightly, in my view, that we should not have American troops in combat. We should not be in direct military confrontation, which could lead to escalation, even potential nuclear conflict. Putin knows that an attack on Poland will precipitate a full NATO response. If he attacks one, he attacks all.
Senator Blumenthal, again, we welcome you back to the States. Thank you for your perspective this morning. We know you have a roundtable discussion coming up today, and we appreciate you taking the time to talk to us ahead of time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Good to be back. Thank you.
If you didn't know, now you will. March is National Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and the whole purpose of this awareness is to protect people's health. Many people face hurdles in accessing life-saving resources to prevent, detect, and treat colorectal cancer, like screening, high-quality care, clinical trials, precision medicine, and supportive communities. And this morning, I am excited to have on the show Dr. Dan Levy. Dr. Levy is with St. Vincent's Medical Center. He's a specialist. And my understanding, Doc, thank you for being here this morning, is you're seeing younger and younger patients screening for colorectal cancer.
Yes, thank you very much for having me. We know a couple things about colorectal cancer. Overall, the disease is actually on the decline. more people are getting regular colonoscopies. But what's scary is the disease, we're seeing a sharp increase in patients aged 20 to 49, a population that, you know, is years away from getting their first colonoscopy.
So how young are you screening people?
So the recommendations have recently changed. It used to be everyone who's 50 gets a colonoscopy, but because of the sharp increase that we're seeing in the younger population, the U.S. Preventative Task Force, the American College of Surgeons, the American Cancer Society, they have all recommended that we begin screening at the age of 45. Now, I think family history plays a big part of that. So, you know, based on your family history, we may begin to screen earlier than that as well.
You know, what's interesting, too, about colon cancer, Dr. Levy, is that a lot of people, when they hear colon cancer, they'll mostly think that men are diagnosed with it. But would you say women are just as much at risk as getting colorectal cancer as men?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's we see it across the board in men and women and in all ethnicities as well.
Yeah, I was seeing in your notes here, Dr. Levy, that it sounds like you're seeing more African-American patients, unfortunately.
Yes. And, you know, we don't exactly understand why the African-American population, you know, it's interesting that about they're 20% more likely to get colon and rectal cancer and about 40% more likely to die from it than other groups. We can't exactly put our finger on it. We know the biology of the cancer is a little bit different. We see them at an earlier age, and there's also some socioeconomic factors that play into it as well. I think it's changed our practice in that we're more inclined to start screening these patients sooner.
We're chatting this morning with specialist Dr. Dan Levy. Dr. Levy, if you don't mind me asking, how long have you been in practice in treating and looking at patients when it comes to colorectal cancer?
So 4 years now in the Connecticut area. Most of my training was at Cleveland Clinic in Florida, where we saw we had extensive training in colon and rectal surgery.
The reason I ask that question is because I'm wondering why you think we're seeing colorectal cancer in younger and younger people. Why has that happened?
So we don't exactly understand the reason. We think it's multifactorial. There's certainly an environmental component. We're noticing that diets high in processed meats give you an increased risk for colorectal cancer. We know there's a role in our microbiome, which is the bacteria that live inside of our gut. And we also know that there's a genetic component. And all three of these are contributing to cancer formation. But at a younger age, we don't exactly understand it. But what's important is we kind of educate the population that this is a problem. And it's not a taboo topic to talk about if you have some of the symptoms.
Do you mind going through some of the symptoms, Dr. Levy?
Absolutely. The most common symptom that people experience is rectal bleeding, abdominal pain, any unintentional weight loss that's not planned, bloating, cramping, or changes to your bowel habits. These are all kind of red flag symptoms that don't necessarily mean you have cancer, but just something to talk to your doctor about, to bring to their attention to see if you qualify for screening.
And what's interesting, in my opinion, Dr. Levy, is I find more and more, and maybe I'm just very hyper aware of it, but I find more and more medications being advertised on television for digestive health, for going to the bathroom regularly, like a Linzess, for example. I find more and more medications being advertised and highlighted, and I'm wondering if it's because we're seeing younger and younger people getting colorectal cancer. Are you finding that more people are needing medication because of things like you said, you know, processed meats, for example? Like for many people, that's just a way of life. The way that we eat now is totally different than it was two generations ago. And I'm wondering if you're seeing an uptick in people needing medication in order to just go regularly and have a clean colon.
I think constipation's a very, very broad topic. There's a lot of reasons why people would have constipation. I think our diet as Americans is very high in processed food and low in fiber. And I think a high-fiber diet has been shown to prevent things like hemorrhoids, diverticulosis, and even some studies show colon cancer. So the first step, you know, is always a high-fiber diet. And I think that, you know, may prevent some of these conditions we're seeing today. And unfortunately, as Americans, our diet is quite the opposite.
Yeah. I'm wondering, Dr. Levy, it says, as I mentioned, that you screen as young as 45 years old. If you do have a family history, because you had mentioned that before, do you recommend people getting screened even earlier than that?
Absolutely. You know, especially the recommendations say that if you have a first degree relative with colon rectal cancer or polyps before the age of 60, you should really start screening at 40 or 10 years younger than the earliest diagnosis in their family. So definitely if know your family history if you can. And I think it definitely plays an important role in screening for colon cancer.
Dr. Dan Levy, we appreciate you taking the time this morning and talking about this with our audience. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely. Dr. Dan Levy, a specialist with St. Vincent's Medical Center, talking about Colorectal Cancer Month right here on WICC. And as he mentioned, now the recommendation is to get screened as early as 45 years old. So if you are in that age range or if you have a family history of it, please call your doctor and set up getting a colonoscopy done. Get a screening done immediately.
Let's get wild. It's the Zoo Minute with Greg Dancho from Connecticut's Beardsley Zoo on Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600.
Well, St. Patrick may have gotten rid of all the snakes in Ireland, but there are plenty of them in Connecticut. And I'm really hoping Greg Dancho can be a snake charmer this morning, because I have to be honest with you, Greg, I think this is a great St. Patrick's Day topic, but I do not like snakes whatsoever. They are just like my least favorite animal on the planet, and I'm hoping you can sway me to feel somewhat otherwise. Because I know you like them. You like reptiles, right? Don't you like reptiles?
I do like reptiles. I grew up in an area that had woods and ponds and lakes and streams, and I would go out there, and that's what I did. I'd go out there and collect snakes, bringing them home. My mother hated them, just like basically a lot of people do. I even went around and collected old TVs. You remember the old TV? Well,
sure.
You probably remember the old TV. The old TVs actually had tubes in them.
Yes.
I'd get the tubes out of them, and I'd make aquariums because I couldn't afford to buy an aquarium. So I'd go around on junk day and take the old TVs, take the tubes out of them, and put the glass in front, and then I'd have a little snake exhibit in my room.
So, you're like actually way too cool for school, Greg. I'm not even joking. That's so innovative. I love that. I mean, I don't like snakes,
Try doing that with a flat screen now.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Forget it.
Doesn't work as well.
That's crazy.
So St. Patrick's Day is, people know that's the thing that St. Patrick took the snakes out of Ireland. Really not true. It's really more of a geographic area. There's only about four countries in the world right now that have no snakes. That's Ireland, New Zealand, Iceland, and Greenland, and mostly because of the climate. The snakes just can't survive there. However, in Ireland now, the big problem is now people love them as pets. So if you say there's no snakes in Ireland, well, that's not exactly true, because it's become a big pet trade. Because people always know that Ireland doesn't have snakes. So, I have a snake.
So,
and so it becomes a little bit of like a fad thing.
Is it an illegal pet trade, though, or is it they're doing it legally?
It's a legal pet trade. Again, people have to know how to raise their pets. So it does become a concern. But there is snakes in Ireland now.
Okay.
But in Connecticut, there's 14 snakes. We have 14 native snakes in Connecticut. And only two are poisonous, the northern copper and the timber rattlesnake. And both of them are in areas that really are not populated by people. So we don't really have to worry about them. The snakes that you'll see around your yard are really the garter snake. Yep. A lot of people call them garden snakes because they're usually found in around gardens, because that's where the worms are and that's what the garter snake eats. But they're garter snakes. And the most common snake is the northern brown snake. And that snake's only about 12 inches long, 12 to 14 inches long. It's light brown. People get scared of it because they think it could be a copperhead because it's got that coppery color to it, but they're real thin. And they're found mostly around houses. They really migrate around houses because that's where the warmth is. So in the springtime, right about now, they'll start to come out of hibernation and they'll find the warm areas, the sunny spot of the house where it gets a lot of radiation heat. And they will sit there and bask themselves to get themselves warmed, because they are cold-blooded and they need to warm themselves up to make sure their bodies can be operational. But people don't like – they really are afraid of snakes. And it's mostly because people don't know about them. And, you know, when you start thinking about, well, they can't blink their eyes because they don't have any eyelids. You know, how do they smell? Well, they smell with their tongue. Their tongue sticks out. When their tongue comes out, people go, oh, he's afraid of that tongue. It's evil looking, right? It comes out of their tongue and kind of waves in the air, and it goes back in. Well, the reason it's doing that, it's picking up molecules in the air, and when it brings it back in, it sticks the tongue up into the roof of its mouth. And in the roof of its mouth, it's called the Jacob's organ. And then the Jacob's organ then deciphers what is around it. Was the food items around it, what the environment's around it. So that's really where the snake gets a lot of its information about where it is and what's going on around it. So again, even though they look at that people call them slimy, because, you know, well, if snakes are slimy, well, no, there's no slimy snakes. They're cold-blooded. So a lot of people will pick up a snake and think that, well, it's, you know, they'll feel the cold to it, because if it's in a cold environment, the body will be cold. Mm-hmm. And they'll associate the cold body to a sliminess. Mm-hmm. And, you know, usually they toss it away. So those are a couple of things that really, and people see the sheds in the yard. It's a lot of misconceptions, and I'll tell you a quick story. Is I went to do a group years ago. I was asked to go to a group meeting about people's fears, and it was a large group of people. And I didn't know I was a magician, because with the large group, you're talking about fear, general fears. And when I came in the room, I was supposed to talk about snake fears, but they didn't know that. So I didn't really know as a magician. So when I reached into the bag they had, where it brought out a snake, the room disappeared. I don't know where everybody went, but the room just went poof.
Yes.
But really, at the end of the meeting, you know, when you start to learn about these things, just about anything else. I mean, this is kind of an analogy for a lot of things. Once you start learning about something and getting the actual facts and information, you realize the fears are really unfounded. Mm-hmm. And snakes won't bite unless they feel threatened. You know, so it's one of the things. Once you learn about it, I think it becomes understand about it. And I think that's again, like I said, an analogy for a lot of things. I snakes again have been a big part of my life, and we have right now, of course, in the zoo we have our snake in the grain and a rainforest building that's green. It's emerald tree boa from South America. So we do have the wearing of the green for one of the snakes in our zoo today. So he's one of my favorites. We got him when he was a baby. He was all different colors, orange and black and different colors that they modeled to be able to protect themselves in the rainforest to you know, blend in a little bit. And as they get older, they become a lime green, very, very pretty snake. So I'm one of my favorites.
Interesting. I did not know that. Okay. Well, I respect the snake. You definitely debunked some things I thought about
snake. Next time we'll have to do the encounter. Next time you come to the zoo, we'll do a little snake encounter.
I don't know, Greg.
You know who's not afraid? You know who's not going to be afraid? You know who's not going to be afraid of snakes?
It's Chase.
Chase.
I know he
Chase
already
will not
is.
Be afraid of snakes.
And I okay. Who? You ever watch the movie Old Yeller?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Okay, you know when Alis, the younger brother, comes in mm-hmm. and he takes off his shoes and the mom goes to like clean the shoes and pulls the snake out and he's like, oh, mom, it's just a little garter snake. And she's like, I don't care, get it out of here. I say to Chase all the time, I'm like, do not make me pull anything out of your shoes. I swear you will live outside.
The thing. The kids when they're young, the fears are not there.
No kidding.
And so that's really one of the things with the zoo we really really try to impress. Come to the zoo, learn about the animals, you know, and again with the kids, I've never had a problem working with when I just started at the zoo.
Yeah.
I'd get one of the big boas out and I'd sit outside and let the guests come over and they would the parents would all stay way back.
Of course we would. Absolutely. The kids love it though.
They all come over, and when they see a kid's eyes, when they actually feel a snake's skin and feel how soft, and it really it's just an amazing feeling. You can see their eyes light up, and you know that those kids are not going to grow up afraid of snakes.
Well, yep, no, my kid is already one of those. He touches frogs, and it's so interesting because no other reptiles bother me. None of them bother me. It's really bizarre. I have always been fearful of them since I was a kid, like little. I can remember going to a birthday party at a friend's house, and it was like, you know, when you have like you know, somebody bring, you know, touch the animals and things like that. As soon as the snake came out, I ran so fast. I almost ran into traffic. I ran so friggin' fast out of that backyard. And my mom's like, well, we're not doing any more of those birthday parties because you can't handle them. I was only in like first grade, Greg. I don't know what it is. I have always been weird about them. I don't know.
Yeah,
but
well, my wife is not a fan either.
And okay, so I'll hang out with her.
She knows that.
And you go
yeah,
do your
she's
snake
not a fan.
Thing. Okay,
and
there you go.
It's not good to be the wife of a zoo director and we love snakes.
That's true.
And it works out.
Oh, your poor wife. Well, she can come hang out with me, and we'll trade. I'll give you Chase, and I'll take your wife, and we'll just have our own dates that day. That'll be fine.
Just the last thing is that, again, we see a snake in the yard. It's part of the ecology. You know, they're not, again, the only poisonous ones are very, very located up in different areas. People think that water snakes are a cottonmouth. They don't even come anyway up toward Connecticut. So if you see a snake in the yard, you don't know what it is, let it be on its way. They can't run. They can't move as fast as you can. You just walk away and let them be on their own.
No problem.
And
no
if you're, and if
problem.
You're St. Patrick, and if you're St. Patrick, maybe you have some bigger sway there.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, there you go. Greg Dancho, very interesting, though, for our Zoom Minute. Thank you so much.
All right. You guys have a great day.
Thank you. You too.